go a long way towards supporting the programs you rely on as a donation. To donate it to KPFK, call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
And welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we turn to Ukraine, speaking to Vermont Senator Tanya Vyhovsky, a Ukrainian-American elected official who just returned from a fact-finding trip in Ukraine. Senator Vyhovsky, a progressive Democrat and member of DSA, spent weeks traveling across Ukraine from Kyiv to Lviv to Kryvyi Rih and Dnipro, meeting with trade unionists, feminist activists, students, and survivors of Russia's bombardment and terror. Her visit coincided with Putin's photo op summit, meeting with Donald Trump, discussing Ukraine without Ukraine at the table. And she's joining us to share what she witnessed on the ground, the resilience of Ukraine's people, the role of trade unions in the war effort, and the daily terror of Russian bombardment. We'll also discuss how the U.S. left should respond to Ukraine's struggle for survival and the urgency of international solidarity at a time when global authoritarianism is on the rise. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we hear from Vermont State Senator Tanya Vyhovsky, just back from spending a few weeks in Ukraine. Her online diary of her trip is on Facebook, and it's an eye-opener, and we're fortunate to have her with us. Senator Vyhovsky traveled across the country from Kyiv to Lviv, Kryvyi Rih, and Dnipro, and as I said earlier, meeting with trade unionists, feminist students, and others, and it came at exactly the time when Putin sat down with Donald Trump in Alaska. I think I called it the distraction in Alaska, pointedly, without President Zelensky at the table. So we're going to get her on-the-ground reflections and analysis of Ukraine at war and what this struggle against Russia's attempt to wipe out Ukraine as a sovereign country signals for the world and the central role of labor and grassroots organization in keeping society alive and the urgency of international solidarity. So with all of that, I want to welcome you to the program for the first time. And let me just properly introduce you. Tanya Vyhovsky served one term in the House of Representatives from Vermont and is now a state senator. She's also a clinical social worker with a practice that primarily supports adolescents and transition age young adults. She serves on the Judiciary Committee and is a vice chair of the Government Operations Committee in the Vermont State Senate, and is working on multiple projects to support the people of Ukraine as they fight for their sovereignty, driven in no small part by her Ukrainian heritage and the family and friends she has who are living there. And Senator Vyhovsky is a member of the Vermont Progressive Party and DSA, so I hope I got all that right. I really want to welcome you to the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. It's really wonderful to be here, and I'm excited to, you know, have a conversation and hopefully build more international solidarity, both with Ukraine, but really globally. We're all in a dangerous spot, and we need to stand together.
Maybe we should just start with you sharing some of the most powerful moments of your trip, what you saw and heard and felt on the ground in Ukraine. You describe a lot in your posts on it about crying at memorials for murdered children, meeting displaced families. First of all, let's hear what your reflections were and then maybe talk a bit about how these encounters shape what your sense of what solidarity means.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly, you know, it was hard to know what to expect, you know, going in. And I was struck by the really stark sort of juxtaposition. You know, people have been under constant siege and bombardment in Ukraine for nearly 4 years, and their lives have to go on. You know, so you saw people who were living with daily air raids and daily sirens, who were living their lives, you know, taking their kids to school, going to work, going to see music and eat at restaurants. And so that was a really stark sort of juxtaposition to recognize that even when the sky is actually falling, you can't live in panic for four straight years. And so you have to find out how to continue. But I also think that that speaks to the incredible resilience of the Ukrainian people, you know, during this struggle for their sovereignty, for their existential existence, they're continuing to fight for better working conditions and, you know, better living conditions. And so it was, it was really incredible, the resolve and the resiliency of the people that I met and spoke to. And certainly, you know, from many people, I heard that they're tired, but they're not broken. And the cohesiveness and connectedness of the left in Ukraine was also, frankly, incredible. Of course, in the context of war, but also in the context of being a fairly young democracy in some ways. In other ways, Ukraine is actually an incredibly old democracy. But because of, you know, the USSR and the occupation of Ukraine, then 1991 was when they declared that portion of their independence. And they're in facing such strong pushes to, in order to get away from being part of Russia, to be very much like the US. And so they're caught in this incredible space. And it was really incredible to see how connected and united the left was in fighting for something better than a neoliberal carbon copy of what we're doing in the United States.
And then, can I just interrupt for a second there? Because I think this is a really important point. And I've talked to several members in Ukraine, the social movement, Socialny Rukh, who have since joined forces and are in the armed forces fighting sometimes at the front line. And I've asked them, as leftists who have strong disagreements, say, with the neoliberal or anti-labor policies that the government sometimes put forward, how they see that and how they square that with their politics. And for them, it's a no-brainer. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I spoke to a couple of different people about that and certainly challenged some of my own views on what it means to be a leftist and what it means to, you know, believe in peace and not war. And certainly, I also have always felt that it was a no-brainer that you defend yourself, you defend your country, you know, you fight for sovereignty. And of course, you know, none of the movement towards strong worker protection and towards a more social future for Ukraine is possible under Russian occupation. And so I think that there's that piece. But thinking of some of the people that I spoke to about what their process was like to, you know, whether it be joining the military or working to support, you know, the defense of the country. And I'm thinking of some of the people that I spoke to. Yes, it was, you know, members of Solzhenitsyn Rukh who had joined the front lines who were able to come and spend some time with me, you know, on a short leave. I also spoke with Maxim Butkevich, who is a humanitarian journalist and spent 2.5 years as a Russian prisoner of war, you know, and he was talking about how his views have shifted on the complexity of what it means to be part of Europe and what it means to be, you know, in this fight that's on its face said to be about NATO. And I spoke to a young veteran who was disabled in fighting, who now runs a leftist collective that does R&D and drone development for the military. You know, I certainly didn't think I would ever find myself talking to a leftist drone collective so so it really challenged me to think differently and to consider in a different way that when an existential threat comes, you do everything you can to tackle that threat. And that may mean that you step outside of things that you thought you would do or you thought you could fight for, you know. And all of the people that I spoke to were still critical of the government and critical of those leftist policies, but they really truly do understand it is in fact a no-brainer that none of the work they're fighting for, none of the things they care about are possible if there is no Ukraine, if they're under Russian occupation.
I'm struck too by, I think it was a feminist, a Ukrainian feminist who told you there are no issues independent of the war.
Yeah.
So that's it, right? It's a single issue. But you met with a lot of feminists and you also met with student groups and trade unions. Can you tell us a little bit about like what it was like and what, let's say, the clarity that they show in terms of what this is?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I started out my week in Kyiv and I met there with students and both the federated trade unions and the independent trade unions. And so there are sort of two trade union movements that have some tension between them in Ukraine. You know, the federated trade unions are more in the sort of old Soviet style of just providing social benefit, whereas these younger independent trade unions are much more politically active, much more recognizing that they have to fight for more. They have to fight for workers' rights and not simply distribute, you know, toys at the holidays for kids. And so there's this tension between the two unions that was really interesting, but also there was some recognition from some that that tension's required. That tension is required because, you know, the people who aren't causing trouble can get garner certain things, but the people who are causing trouble can push for more. And that there is both tension and unity in that fight for better working conditions, including better working conditions for the military and for people on the front. You know, one of the conversations that came up a lot was this fight for stricter contract standards for people on the in the military, both who enlist and who are conscripted. And so it really became clear to me through all of my conversations that there is nothing that is separate, you know, from the war. When I was talking to the Federated Trade Union for the building constructors, they were grappling with a lack of workforce because so much of their workforce is at the front, but also, you know, houses need to be rebuilt because Russia's bombing them every day. And so they had worked to stand up this makeshift training center where they're taking people with no construction experience and in 2 weeks' time training them to go rebuild houses and rewire houses. And they were telling me, you know, they're training teachers and retired grandmothers, and they're out, like, the citizens are out saying, you know what, the people who would usually do this are at the front defending our freedom, and so we're going to go rebuild their houses. And so just that unity is so incredible to see, you know. And the students, obviously, depending on where I was, the issues were different. You know, the students in Kyiv are grappling with the fact that young men can't leave the country to do Erasmus or some of the things that they would normally do. They're grappling with, what degree path do I take that puts me in the best position to be able to help my country without necessarily dying? To really wrap your head around that being how people are making decisions about what they're going to study in school and what career they're going to choose, you know, whereas in Lviv, the student unions were far more focused on pressuring the universities to build more student housing so that there wasn't this artificially created issue between students from Lviv and internally displaced students. Because the population of Lviv has grown so much that there is housing prices are skyrocketing. There's not enough student housing. And the students union was very clear that it's every Ukrainian's job to make sure that internally displaced Ukrainians are welcomed and safe and part of the communities they have had to flee to. And that that's on the university and the government to make sure that that housing is available and those supports and services are available. And that as a union, they have some ability to put pressure on that. And
do they have to fight on that? Or is it an issue? I mean, I'm certain it's an economic issue, but is it an issue where, for example, there might be some resentment against, you know, those who come in or not? Is it different because it's at war?
I certainly didn't. I mean, I didn't, you know, speak to every single Ukrainian, but I didn't hear resentment about internally displaced people. I really heard much more of a, we're going to welcome you with open arms and we're going to figure out how to make it work. You can sleep in my living room until we like this real, again, sense of solidarity. The fight has been with in Lviv with the national university sort of administration. And actually, just a couple days after I got home, one of the student organizers posted something about how they were actually planning to kick all of the graduate students out of housing instead of just making more housing.
Wow.
And they're fighting back. They're pushing back. You know, they were talking about, you know, how they were going to challenge that and what they needed for help from the community. And this is all under the context of martial law, where mass organizing events like that are illegal.
Yeah. I think it would be really good here to spend a couple of minutes talking about how this war is perceived around the world and what you've just described inside Ukraine, where it's an actual struggle so that Ukraine survives as Ukraine. And it's something that Putin, you know, has said, you know, there are little brothers. It's not really a country. And it's been this way. It's really quite an interesting history. because it's been this way off and on throughout the history. I'm a student of Soviet history, and I know in the 1930s they had first, you know, a Ukrainian language policy, and then they had a Russian language policy. And so one year, you know, all of the textbooks were in Ukraine in the schools, and the next year they scrapped all those and everybody had to do it in Russian. And it's been this on again, off again. And even during Stalin's purge, at one point he wanted to deport all the Ukrainians to, you know, Siberia, until someone said, but there's more than 40 million of them. So, yeah, can't do that. But it kind of just shows that Ukraine is critical for Russia's, you know, agriculture and industry, or was during the Soviet period. And they've always just assumed that it's part of their empire, you know, and that seems to be what Putin is doing. And then on the other hand, this could take us into the discussion about how the left globally, literally, it used to be just sort of the global south and those people in BRICS countries that wanted to have Putin's favor. But unfortunately, there's so many who say this is a NATO-Russia proxy war and accept the Kremlin lines. So I guess I want to ask a little bit about why that you think that persists and how it can be countered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something I've grappled with, you know, as a leftist, as a Ukrainian American, as someone who grew up having some knowledge of my family heritage and my family history. It's been a really difficult time to sit in leftist spaces and to, yeah, it's been really difficult, you know, and I've spent a lot of time trying to understand it, and a lot of time being angry and upset. And the way I make the most sense of it is sort of, there's a few different sort of camps of people. Some of them are, for whatever reason, just accepting Russian propaganda as fact and not doing any looking into this history, because the history of Ukraine is very rich and in fact predates the modern concept of Russia.
Oh, yeah. Kievan Rus. Yes. Way back.
It goes way back.
Way back. Yeah.
You know,
Kiev is one of the, for our listeners, you know, there were only three cities that existed way, way back. And it was Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Kiev.
And this grappling for independence and freedom also, as you pointed out, spans centuries of Ukrainian history, you know, whether it was the Cossacks trying to expel, or it was, you know, the points that you brought up, whether it was, you know, the USSR, or it was the Bolsheviks, like this is just this constant cycle through history of Ukraine fighting for its freedom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think there's that. I'll also say, you know, I just don't think people truly understand that history or that part of the world. I mean, growing up, when people would ask me like, oh, Vyhovsky, that's a funny name, is that Russian? And I would say, oh no, it's Ukrainian. They were like, oh, it's the same thing. And I was like, no, that's actually really offensive. People, I mean, I think 5 years ago, the vast majority of Americans, including the left, probably couldn't have pointed Ukraine out on a map.
No, and it's interesting to me, one other aspect of it is people didn't say Ukraine, they said the Ukraine. And the Ukraine, just for those who know, Ukraine in Russian means border. So it's like saying the border, not like it's, you know, a country. I learned that when I was in grad school from Ukrainian students there. Can't say the Ukraine. Just like they used to say the Argentine, you know, the Brits.
I still have to correct people on that. I still have to correct people on that. And, you know, really uninformed people will still occasionally say things like, oh, if, you know, you like communism so much, go back to Russia. And I'm like, okay, well, first of all, like, I'm a democratic socialist. Second of all, I'm not Russian. You know, so I think there's just a wholesale lack of understanding as one piece of this puzzle. I also think that there is a sense, it's sort of like it's American exceptionalism, but in its reverse. So, you know, there's the people who have taken the American propaganda that America's the best place on earth. We do everything the best. There's no other way to do anything. America's the center of the world. And obviously that's not true. But I think there's another side of this that sort of seeks to counter this in the most black and white way possible. And they're like, well, America's terrible. Everything America does is awful, and everything they are involved in, we should reject. And that, I think, drives some of this as well, because the U.S. has been supportive of Ukrainian freedom. And so I think there's also the sort of hard line of like, well, if the U.S. is involved, it's bad.
Yeah.
Which is also just missing again, so much of the gray area and so much of the complexity of geopolitics. And I think there's also a wholesale rejection on the left of Eastern imperialism. They sort of view imperialism as a uniquely Western thing, not recognizing that imperialism is wrong no matter who does it. Yes, it's bad when the U.S. does imperialism, but it's also bad when Russia's doing imperialism.
This is also like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, you know, this is the critical issue, which I'm sure you come up against all the time. I do, too, that those, you know, who say they're anti-war and that this war is a proxy war and it's NATO and, you know, accepting essentially, as I said earlier, the Kremlin line, it's NATO versus Russia, which, first of all, you have to say gives no agency to Ukraine. Ukraine's just incidental in that. But also it's really facile, you know, and it's to hide behind it as like, oh, well, if you're in favor of Ukraine, somehow you're no longer anti-war. Right. So how do you talk to people about that?
I mean, it of course, it depends on who I'm talking to. And I think the other piece of this is, you know, and I try to frame it that way. Yeah, I'm anti-war. And the idea that allowing Russia to use aggression to invade, take over and occupy a sovereign nation is somehow going to equate to peace is lunacy. That's not peace. It's not peace for the people living in occupied Ukraine. It's not peace for the long term. We already know this because we tried that in 2014. You know, Putin invaded Crimea and was like, this is mine now. And everyone was like, okay, well, as long as you stop there. But of course, he was never going to stop there. And hearing stories from people who were living in occupied Crimea are horrific. And so that's not peace. I think it's challenging people to step away from an elementary understanding of what is peace. If Ukraine stops fighting, there's not going to be peace. Not just not in Ukraine, but I don't truly believe that Putin stops there. If Russia stops fighting, we have peace. The war ends. And so I think it's, again, digging into the gray area. And, you know, sometimes I try to just really challenge people on something that's personal to them. You know, I had a discussion with someone who was in this camp of we can't be spending any money to do war. And so we can't help Ukraine. They should just give up. I think they even said to me, what's so important about Crimea anyways? And I was like, it's what? And what I said to them is I said, if someone broke into your home and kicked you out and said, and then they sent you to the garage and they're throwing bombs at you in the garage. And then they're like, oh, you know what? We'll stop throwing bombs at you in the garage, but we're keeping your house.
Yeah.
Would you think that that's fair or just?
Right. So while you were in Ukraine, Putin and Trump were meeting in Alaska. I called it the meeting of two criminals seeking distraction in Alaska. And nothing came from their love fest except a lot of, you know, photo ops. No deal was struck. And I, you know, at the time said a Munich in Alaska was averted, thankfully. But I want to know how you saw it. And because it speaks to what you were just talking about, Tanya. And also, what was the view of Ukrainians that you were talking to at the time? What were they saying? And at the same time, we should also, you know, set the stage that while Putin was meeting with Trump in Alaska, bombardments not only continued, but increased.
And they've continued to increase. One of the worst bombings of the war so far occurred last night in Kyiv. They were under air raid for over 12 hours with at least six different residential areas struck with missiles and drones. The last count I knew, 18 people had died, including four children. Mm. It was pretty stark this morning to wake up to the pictures of the sun rising in Kyiv and the skies just filled with smoke. So it's continued to escalate. I didn't expect anything to come of the meeting in Alaska. I expected the best possible case scenario was that nothing changed.
Yeah.
Because the only other thing that was being offered was a full-scale betrayal of the Ukrainian people.
Right.
I don't believe that Putin and Trump have ever been negotiating in good faith. You can't negotiate in good faith without the victim at the table. you can't negotiate in good faith when you are putting forward plans that have again and again been said to be absolutely unacceptable. Like they both full well know, because President Zelensky has said it again and again, the Constitution prohibits me from signing a deal that gives away Ukrainian land. And so for them to put forward a plan that says, oh, well, you'll have to give away Ukrainian land, and not just the land that's occupied, but more land than is currently occupied.
Right. Land that they, I mean, they have a sliver, literally. It's a bigger sliver than it was. But if you look at what Russia has gained in the last year, it's very little. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I mean, I think this is really, really important to stress that, and it's not just land, it's people, and they have no choice in the matter. You know, and so this is really quite extraordinary. And the other side of it, too, that occurred to me is when it looked like Trump was going to say, OK, we'll, you know, do land for peace. But he really is keen on having access to the mineral rights, to the rare earths, as he called it. And that's in the land that he's about to give to Russia. So how do you see this?
I mean, it's, again, I don't believe that Putin wants peace. He wants to obliterate Ukraine. I don't believe that Trump is the master deal maker that he thinks he is. You know, it's hard not to watch these things happening and feel a little bit like it's Putin pulling the strings. And it's, you know, it was interesting speaking to one of the people who came from the front to meet with me and speak to me. And he was sharing that his belief was that if the deal was struck that was being proposed, that there would be riots among service members. You know, the Ukrainians were very clear. We are tired, but we want a just peace. You know, and a lot of them, as it was leading to these meetings, wanted to know what my opinion was, what I thought Ukrainians should do, which I rejected on its face. I don't get a say. Like, I am not, my cities aren't being bombed. My friends and family who are there are, but it's not, I get to go home to my country where we have all of our own problems and lack of safety, but there aren't bombs falling on me. And I'm not fighting at the front, but they would often really push because they were like, no, we really want to know what you think. And so I was able to ground my thoughts without a suggestion of what people should do or shouldn't do in history, both Ukrainian history, but also global history. You know, if we know from what's happening in Palestine that when you occupy a nation for 75 years, what it results in is genocide.
Yeah.
And Russians have already acted in genocidal ways against Ukrainians, both in this most recent escalation with the kidnapping of 20,000 Ukrainian children and sending them to be Russified and denied their Ukrainian identity and heritage, and through history with the Holodomor, where hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians were starved to death by a man.
4 to 7 million.
Okay.
4 to 7 million. For people who don't know about this man-made famine, and of course, you already just touched on Gaza. We'll come back to that in a minute, but keep going, because Ukrainian history is really, I think, instructive in this regard for the world, and they pointed out.
Yes. Well, and I think that is, you know, as I was talking about that, that's exactly what I pointed to, is like Ukraine has this long history that we should learn from. And if Ukraine is standing up saying no, we should listen. And, you know, in addition, even in more recent history, you know, I worry that if a deal is taken that includes occupation of Ukrainian land by Russia, the people who are living in occupied land are not experiencing peace. Maybe the bombs stop falling, but they're not experiencing peace. The people who've been living in Crimea since 2014 are not experiencing peace and have not been. And it's a pause. We know this. We know that if Putin is allowed to illegally invade and use war crimes and terrorism to take parts of a sovereign country, that he will use that time of peace to regroup until he comes back for more. That is basic psychology. If a child throws a tantrum and gets what they want, they're going to throw another tantrum. And I hate to like make it that it's obviously bigger than a tantrum. His tantrums come with bombs and deaths and he's doing it right now. He is escalating. And you know, if he was going to the table in Alaska to negotiate peace, you would think the bombs would have stopped. not increased.
So, and it's very, you know, this is, there's two leaders in the world right now who are bellicose and doing these wars. And for both of them, Putin and Netanyahu, peace is the last thing they want, exactly. Because peace threatens their survival continuing as leader. Netanyahu would go to jail and Putin would, you know, I don't see how he survives this war in power. Of course, that's a completely different discussion. But one of the things I'm really curious, as you started to say that you met with grassroots group who are, you know, quickly building houses and doing other things. And I wonder what else you could tell us about what people on the ground are actually doing, apart from, you know, joining the armed forces, but what kind of, I guess, what we would call broad solidarity actions are taking place literally all the time.
There's so much. And I was so honored to get to visit a small slice of the people that are doing the work. You know, the first day that I was there, we were unsure if I would be completely wiped out from travel. I wasn't, but that's because I wiped myself out the day before and then slept on the overnight train and woke up on the right time zone, well rested. But because we weren't sure how I would be feeling, we kept the day fairly loose. You know, if I was feeling great, we'd go kind of sightsee, which feels bizarre to say in a war, but we also visited some volunteer groups. You know, we went to the grocery store and picked up 30 kilos of chicken, which is a lot of chicken. And we took it to this, you know, small little workshop that has been donated to some women who collect produce that has been donated by farmers from around Ukraine, and they freeze dry it, and then they freeze dry the meat, and they put it together into these little freeze dried bags of various types of soups and oatmeals and nuts. And they use drones to send them into the front to drop them into soldiers who may have been cut off from the supply lines to keep them alive.
Wow.
And this is all volunteer effort. You know, for the most part, all the food is donated. They have a tough time getting meat donations, so usually they try to do some fundraising to raise money to buy meat. And this is, you know, they have another area where they're storing all of this produce, and they're sending out tens of thousands of these little freeze-dried soups to Ukrainian soldiers every week. And they just keep going. And I was able to visit with them and talk to them about their work. And from there, we went and visited with another group of women who, there's about 50 of them total, but there weren't 50 there. But they work Monday through Friday in shifts. Every week, you know, they don't work holidays or weekends. Outside of that, they're working. And what they're doing is they're hand weaving tarps and suits, camouflage, so that they can camouflage sites and camouflage equipment and camouflage people. And they have this set up in a donated space. Unfortunately, the donated space isn't very well heated. And so it gets quite cold in the winter. So they've got their parkas in there for when they're working in the winter. And, you know, they taught me how to do this. So there's like a square foot of one of these tarps that's going to go to the front that I got to weave and send. But these are people donating 2, 3, 5 hours of their day regularly to make sure that the soldiers have camouflage and can camouflage their positions. You know,
and this is all self-directed. This isn't coming from, say, Kyiv, that you must do this. This is what people want to do.
Yes, this is all self-directed. You know, the student or the feminists in Lviv are working to build support and expand education around reproductive justice, you know, and this is what they're doing. And they're really, you know, Ukraine, they were talking about some of the challenges. So abortion is legal in Ukraine. But the providers are allowed to sort of be like, no, we don't really want to do that. And so they're working on compiling a white list of providers and working on trying to get telehealth availability available, particularly to women in the military. And, you know, I could just keep going. There's so much that they're doing. You know, there was the young veteran who retired after a catastrophic injury and set up this drone collective and they're sending drones to the front line that they're doing the research and development on and building in a mechanism by which they share all the profits. They share, like, it's truly a leftist collective that has built this network of sending equipment to the front. You know, the unions are organizing and raising money to send veterans to get the health care that they need, the really critical health care that is at this point really only available in Western nations, in part because of the war. You know, the nurses are organizing to make sure that they have blood analyzers closer to the front so they can provide better, faster patient care.
Right. We've just organized to get donations for those nurses so that they can get it 30 miles from the border.
Yes. And yeah. So it doesn't matter where you look. People are organizing, and there's so much, you know, they were telling me, so right in the main square, the Maidan Independence in Kyiv, there's a huge memorial to fallen soldiers. And they were telling me that that just started at the beginning of the war. A couple of people who'd lost people just put flags down. And every day more flags go down and they read the names of, and it's just grown and grown and grown, which is horrifying that it's gotten so big. Mm-hmm. But it's also, again, it speaks to this like connection and solidarity and this grassroots way that Ukrainians are supporting Ukrainians.
This is really impressive. I think we maybe just spend a second on, you know, because you've talked about the innovative use of drones. And of course, what the Ukrainian army right now is the most advanced and the most prepared army in all of Europe and maybe leading in the world. And the way that it's doing that, of course, is through drones. And at the beginning of the war, Russia was, you know, was fighting a World War I trench warfare with just sending soldiers into the meat grinder and losing at a catastrophic pace. But now Russia, of course, has had time to build up its own drone technology. But I think it's showing, you know, that wars are not like wars anymore in the same way. And even in the United States, you know, I was talking to somebody this morning that our gigantic military budget is for the kind of machinery that's not used anymore in war. You know, and it's now, people-less drones, you know, fighting, but causing, you know, swaths of destruction as they destroy, you know, all of the infrastructure, buildings and everything else. Because you've talked a little bit about that, but how do you see it in terms of, you know, where Ukraine is? Ukraine's lost far fewer soldiers than Russia. Is that because of this, do you think?
I think to some extent that it is. I mean, I think that there has had to be a more strategic, more innovative way because, yes, Ukraine is much smaller than Russia. And so I think from the very beginning, there had to be this sort of innovation and creativity. But also, I mean, yes, Ukraine is often thought of as the breadbasket of Europe, but they also have incredibly advanced technological centers and scientific centers. And these are actually based in some of the areas that Putin is demanding he be given. And Ukraine's history is actually quite full of innovation. And, you know, in Kryvyi Rih, it seems a little silly, but under the Soviet period, they were deemed too small for a metro. And the Ukrainian people there scrapped together parts from the trams and dug a hole and put a tram metro underground. They were like, wow. Fine, we'll make our own. And so there's really a long history of this type of innovation and figuring out like their way through seemingly intractable problems. And so it doesn't come as much of a surprise to me that they looked at the situation and were like, all right, how do we figure this out? And they are sort of continuing to innovate in that area. And, you know, I don't know that I want to publicly share how to give away, you know, those, but they're continuing to build new ways and more efficient ways of doing reconnaissance and doing this sort of drone. And they're seeing success. I mean, they're getting further into the Russian military infrastructure. You know, while I was there, they took out, I want to say something like 18% of the oil refinery capacity in Russia. And Russia had to pivot and say, we can't really sell as much gas because we can't meet our domestic need. That's huge in terms of the economy and grinding the military machine in Russia closer to a halt. You know, they took out $2 billion of Russian aircraft, like military aircraft, because they're able to target more and conceal more and get further in to these, you know, one of the gas refineries they hit was nearly in Siberia.
Wow.
And so they are continuing. And I think that plays a huge role in why they haven't taken as many losses. And of course, every loss is still catastrophic. You know, the left in Ukraine lost a very close personal, you know, friend and hero while I was there in David Chichkon, who was an anarchist and an artist, and he was lost at the front, you know, I think it was August 9th. And of course, then there's the civilian toll. I mean, that is the thing that is just so horrific to me, is the regularity in which Russia is targeting completely civilian targets, whether that be hospitals or children's parks or schools or apartment buildings. And sometimes, you know, when talking to people in Ukraine, they're able to say, you know, maybe the target was actually this factory that's a little ways over there. And there's just there is a measure of error, and it's just callous disregard for if they miss or not. But there were plenty of them that it was like, no, there's nothing here that you could argue was the actual target. And a perfect example of that was in Kryvyi Rih, and this made international news. The Russians used cluster munitions, which are categorized as a war crime no matter where you use them. And their target was a children's park. Next door to the children's park are two big apartment buildings. Across the street is an elementary school. On the other side is a restaurant. There's nothing anywhere nearby that could be conceivably viewed as a military target.
Earlier on Friday evening,
and 19 people died, including 9 children.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, because you said earlier on that there were some similarities between Ukraine and Gaza, and this is in terms of the way that, say, the left perceives this worldwide struggle, and also about, you know, what genocide is. And I would say, just definitionally, you have to say that when Russia says that they're fighting, you know, that first they called Ukrainians Nazis and they have to denazify Ukraine, which was, you know, crazy, but that's genocidal in intent. And here you're talking about the way that civilian targets are, you know, being, you know, the way that civilians are being targeted. You also mentioned about the Ukrainian children who are kidnapped and sent to Russia and fostered out or adopted by Russian families to become Russian children. And, you know, in both wars and in Gaza here, you could say it's a war against children. But I wondered, like, what parallels you see. And I'd love for you to talk just a little bit about the impact of Russia stealing Ukrainian children and how often you've heard about this or talked to people who, you know, whose children were kidnapped.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are similarities, and I think there, and you've named, you've highlighted them really well. And I think there is real danger in breaking solidarity when we start to get into which one's worse, who's got it worse, you know, the sort of trauma Olympics of it. And that's what I've seen sometimes. And I even saw it actually, you know, in some of the things when I, on the posts, like that I was posting every day in Ukraine, someone responded to me the day that I went to the park and had the video of us putting a teddy bear at this memorial for these children. Well, there's no teddy bears in Palestine. And
it's not a contest.
Exactly. Like, what's happening is horrific. And just because someone else is suffering doesn't mean this suffering isn't real and doesn't make any of it okay. And, you know, what's happening in Palestine is the culmination of 75 years of occupation and genocidal behavior. Should we just wait 75 years so it's that bad in Ukraine? Like, I don't think there's room to say both of these things are horrific. Both of these things are genocidal in nature. Both of these things, both of the people who are leading these fights have said out loud publicly that their goal is to wipe the Palestinians and the Ukrainians off the map. That is genocidal.
Right.
And
there's a wonderful, you know, I saw a banner of a pro-Palestinian march in London, and it said from Ukraine to Palestine, occupation is a crime. I think that's a very good slogan.
It is. It is. The first time I heard that actually, that statement actually was when I was in London in March, speaking with the Ukrainian solidarity folks there. And I've brought it back because I think it's really important that we ground ourselves in our core morals and values. And that has to be that occupation is always a crime. Genocide is always wrong, no matter who's doing it.
Right. Can you spend a minute talking about the children who've been kidnapped?
I don't think that they're being talked about enough, honestly, on a global scale. You know, I am paying much closer attention, I think, than many Americans to this struggle because it is so deeply personal to me, and even more so now. It's not being talked about the way that it needs to be talked about. You know, when the Trump administration shut down all of the money to the study that was digging into how many children is it really, you know, the estimate is over 20,000. And some of those children have been taken from occupied Ukraine and sent further into Russia. And some of those children have been taken not from occupied Ukraine. And I haven't actually had the chance at this point to speak directly to a parent who's been impacted, but I have had the opportunity to hear from and sit down with a young woman who mm-hmm. was one of those children.
Wow.
Who was rescued from that experience. And she talked about the torture that she underwent as they tried to literally beat her Ukrainian identity out of her. Ugh. She talked about the brainwashing and propaganda that her younger brother was subjected to as they tried to convince him that Ukraine wasn't real. He wasn't Ukrainian. He was Russian. About the work she does now to try to rehabilitate and support those kids that people are able to get out. And so this is something I don't think we're talking about enough. I mean,
it's a war crime, for
it's
sure.
A war crime. There are so many war crimes here. It's absolutely a war crime. You know, earlier you said that you can't see Putin surviving in power in, you know, this war. He belongs in jail. He is a war criminal.
You know, it's really, as you say this, I think this century is so unthinkable in so many ways that the trajectory of the century changed with Putin's invasion of Ukraine and then with Netanyahu's attempt to obliterate Gaza. We couldn't have imagined this 20 years ago. The world was going in a completely different direction. And yet here we are. And I'm really glad that you talked about this in terms of war crimes, because they both belong in jail, but there's a lot to, you know, recoup afterwards. And you've talked a lot about the importance of international solidarity. Before we sort of, I guess I want to end on that, what people can do, but I'm really curious because you are a state senator and foreign policy isn't normally what you get to do in, say, the Vermont Senate, but here you are. And I wondered first about what your own background, how it informs what you do. You're a socialist, you're a progressive, and you're also Ukrainian. So, you know, can you talk a little bit about how you became an activist and how much each of those areas informed what you do today?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that just it's sort of a long arm that brings any of us to any one space. I think I grew up talking about at the dinner table with my grandmother, largely really different things than a lot of my American peers grew up talking about. You know, my grandmother fled Hungary in 1956 when she was 15 years old and came to the United States after a time in a refugee camp in Germany, not speaking a word of English. And my grandmother has a real sense of what authoritarianism and occupation looks like. And we talked about that, you know, and my grandfather fought. I unfortunately never met my grandfather. He died before I was born, but my grandmother, it was always very important to her that I hear his stories and I be connected to my Ukrainian and Hungarian heritage. He fought for Ukrainian independence in the 1920s and 30s. And he eventually was exiled to Siberia and eventually was able to get out of the country and get to the United States. And so I think we were having really different discussions about authoritarianism and occupation than most of my friends and, you know, growing up. And so I think it left me sort of uniquely attuned to injustice and uniquely attuned to the fact that there is another way to do things and that the choices we make that seem innocuous now can lead us down a very dangerous path. But I also spent time as a young person spending summers with family in Europe and spending, you know, so I also got to travel and see other parts of the world. So I think that is foundational. But then when I graduated college, it was before the Affordable Care Act, and I had pre-existing health conditions. And when I got my first job during the Great Recession and went to sign up for health insurance, that insurance company was able to tell me, we're not going to insure you because you have these pre-existing conditions. And that enraged me. And it drove me to community organizing. It drove me to the Healthcare as a Human Right campaign. It drove me to engaging policymakers, and it led me eventually to getting arrested when Mitch McConnell was leading the charge against the Affordable Care Act. And so that really drove me into activism. And, you know, that's not the only thing I fought for. You know, I also have fought, you know, with unions on the picket lines and for racial justice. But it was that moment for me that like galvanized me into like, we have to do something. And I know there's a better way. You know, I eventually went to grad school, got a master's degree in social work, and where I saw myself even more working with people for whom the systems just were not working. And that actually a lot more of the people that I was engaging with, like most people, the systems weren't working. They were more like me than anyone in government representing us. And after many, many attempts from people to get me to run for office, Senator Sanders was the one who actually finally convinced me to do it. But I also like I bring that grassroots and that activist work into policy making with me, because I'm there making policy for the masses, not just the lobbyists and the rich donors. And I bring that to a broader scale. You know, over the last, I don't know, probably 10 years, what I've really seen is this rise in global authoritarianism. You know, and the fascists and the authoritarians and the oligarchs, they are connected all around the globe. Like it or not, we live in a globalized world. And I think the left and the working class, because of lack of resources, because of lack of mobilization and organization, is woefully behind in making sure that we too are connected across the globe. And I think that that international solidarity is how we beat global authoritarianism.
It was actually going to be my next question, because, you know, I heard you speak. Yeah, I was in a panel with you in Chicago at the Socialism Conference, and I think I ended by saying we should clone you, because we need representatives like you all across the country. And I really mean that. But you've also warned, and you just said now about the importance of solidarity. You've warned against Ukraine becoming a victim of post-war austerity and capitalist plunder. You've talked about incredible initiatives on the ground that show effective, real solidarity in the moment. And it's really hard to imagine that, say, at the end of the war, however that looks, that people will just go home and go back to their lives and accept not just the status quo ante if they get there, but a worse condition. So maybe you could just sort of talk a little bit about how international solidarity is important in preventing that, and how Ukraine's struggle is our struggle too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're all in this struggle against austerity, and certainly in the United States, I mean, we're in a space, and the Ukrainians were shocked when I shared some of these facts. 60% of Americans can't afford a surprise $500 bill. The single greatest reason people go bankrupt is because of medical care, because they get sick. You know, more and more people going into hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt because they want an education. Meanwhile, our schools are being privatized and our hospitals are being privatized. And you know, so some of, you know, we can learn from the Ukrainians. If during a war, when martial law says you cannot organize, they can take to the streets and stop a bad policy taking away independence from anti-corruption organizations, are falling on their heads, we can too. And so I think it's also like this connecting and learning from one another and learning what works here and what works there. And so, yeah, I was in Ukraine speaking and connecting, and you know, a lot of the ask that I had was to, you know, bring hope, bring legitimacy to this leftist organizing and movement. But it was such a, I gained so much as well, you know, learning about the both personally from, you know, my own family history and my own, you know, sort of ancestral history that was offered to me, but also just in terms of like, how are these movements working? The struggle for Ukraine is the struggle for global democracy, the struggle for a free social Ukraine after this war is the struggle for all of us, all of the working class, to finally rise up against austerity, against oligarchy, and say, no, enough is enough. You don't get to own the world and divide up the assets. We're human beings.
I mean, that's brilliant. I want to just finally ask you, Senator Verhofstadt, if you're optimistic about how this will all turn out.
It's hard to be optimistic right now. It's really difficult, you know, when we're looking at the Trump administration and we're looking at Putin's current bombardment of the country. And I know that the Ukrainians are not going to give up. And I know that they have a long history of fighting. And I know that that fighting can, and the optimism and the success can be bolstered with solidarity, whatever that looks like. I mean, right now there's, you know, all of those efforts that I named and more that need monetary support. They need material support. You know, people can stand in solidarity by talking about what's going on, talking about what's on the ground, having these types of conversations, educating themselves. Like, there are so many different ways that we can stand in solidarity. And what I heard from so many people that I met with while I was there is that my going there meant so much. It gave them so much hope, so much more energy to keep fighting, to know that I was willing to go there, put myself at risk, to stand with them. And that doesn't mean everyone has to travel to Ukraine. There's lots of ways that we can do this. There are lobby days almost every month at Congress lobbying to get the material support to Ukraine that is needed. And so there's all kinds of different ways to help.
I think that's really important. And I, you know, we're in the United States, we're not in Europe, but I think for Europeans, it's also really important to pressure their governments, because they said once Trump pulled back the support that they could freeze the you know, that there are Russian frozen assets that they could utilize to fight back, but they haven't done so. So that needs, you know, that's an area of struggle for them. But finally, you would just say then what to the Americans?
I mean, what I want to say to the American people is to open their minds, open their hearts, and recognize that we are talking about real people with real bombs falling on their heads who want nothing more than their freedom, their sovereignty, and justice, so that they can continue the fight for a social Ukraine.
Tanya Verhofstadt, thank you so much for spending all this time with us today. I know you're really busy, but I just want to let the listeners know that Tanya is a state senator in Vermont, which just keeps giving us more and more terrific progressive candidates, including Bernie Sanders, of course. And she is Ukrainian American and just came back from a 2-week, I guess, a tour of Ukraine. Thank you so much for sharing that with us today. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Senator Tanya Verhofstadt. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, and editor-engineer Juliana Gota and Ossi Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archived shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. Again, that's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. And stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
I'm back, baby!
Ciclovia Historic South Central meets Watts has been rescheduled for Sunday, September 14th. There'll be fun activities, sights to see, and open streets to enjoy. KPFK will be located at the Central Avenue Hub, 8403 South Central Avenue, Los Angeles, 90001. That's Ciclovia, Historic South Central meets Watts. New date, Sunday, September 14th, 2025, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Ciclovia events welcome people of all ages and abilities. For more details and street closure information, visit kpfk.org and ciclavia.org.
La agencia ICE está intensificando las operaciones de deportación en el área de Los Ángeles. Pero si lo detienen agentes de la ICE, usted tiene derechos constitucionales sin importar su estatus migratorio. Si usted o alguien que conoce ha sido detenido o desea denunciar a la ICE, puede obtener más información en CHIRLA, llamando al 888-624-4752 para obtener ayuda legal y recursos. Es un servicio bilingüe. Para más información, visite chirla.org.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being